Campus FM presents The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers.
Welcome to The Probe with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Professor Engineer David Zamit Manjon, who's the Director of the Institute of Aerospace Technologies here at the University of Malta. I bet you didn't even know we had one of those, but they're doing some amazing work. So tell us, you were telling us earlier about how much funding you've brought into the university.
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much for the invite. Well, we've been pretty busy in trying to develop our activities into one which is self-sustaining, and we've been successful at that. The paradigm we tried to bring in was to work internationally with European and partners beyond. And we've been successful in attracting about €4 million of contracts, worth of contracts, about 15 or 16 contracts to date in the last 10, 12 years.
What sorts of companies are those with?
Mainly European, because we're part of the European research area. So we're talking of Airbus, Thales, who are the major avionics manufacturers, BAE Systems, universities like Cranfield and Braunschweig, other research establishments like CIRA of Italy and ALAR of Holland and DLR of Germany. We've worked with people like Boeing, Rockwell Collins and Honeywell in the States. So, yes, those sort of organizations.
So what sort of work do you do then that allows you to attract such contracts? What are you doing for these industry partners?
We try to be as of greatest value as possible to the industry. That adds value to universities. It bridges the big divide between academia and industry, and we find that very exciting. When you find your niche in an area, working in an environment you can provide added value in, it becomes even more exciting. So we try to look into, we work in what is called downstream research, which is applied research. So we take existent principles, if you like, and apply them and adopt them and integrate them in the aviation environment. That is very, very challenging. And for industry, that is called advanced studies. So you can see there downstream research from academic perspectives and very advanced research in industrial parlance.
So I was going to say, what sort of, you know, physical projects are you working on today for industry?
Well, we're working on a number of projects. One of them is looking at how to control an aircraft using touch technologies and voice technologies.
Like a model aircraft?
No, a real aircraft. So you're flying an A380, for example, you're a pilot, and you don't push levers and turn knobs anymore. You talk to the aircraft and you communicate via touchpad.
Okay. Why would, sorry, I'm nervous flying. Why would you go down that route? Why would you go down the touchpad route for flying a plane?
Well, the primary motive is reduction of costs.
Okay.
Because you'll be surprised how much a knob and the lever costs. So repairing that and replacing that in the field is not only expensive from a maintenance point of view, but also in terms of downtime. If you have to, imagine you've got 500 passengers on an A380, and you've got to put the aircraft in maintenance in the last minute. You've got to find a replacement aircraft, which will cost you an arm and a leg. You've got delays, you've got compensations. It upsets your whole schedule in terms of flight operations. It's a very expensive incident. So reduction of downtime is significant. The other thing is also acquisition costs. A touchpad will cost much less than knobs and switches. The other aspect is also safety and pilot workload. The aim is to reduce pilot workload in the cockpit. We have this image that pilots do nothing but read papers or sleep or whatever. Well, that is partially true, because you can't allow a pilot to become too bored, because the level of attentiveness will drop too much. But you can't allow a pilot to be working too hard, because in the event of an incident, he or she would not be able to cope with the new events. So there's a level of alertness and workload which you need to keep and not surpass. So reducing workload in high workload conditions is always a key aspect, and doing things quicker and simpler is a very, very important aspect. So if you talk, for example, to the aircraft, it's a very quick way of programming the aircraft.
Obviously, but because pilots obviously come from all around the world and they're going to have different accents and things like that, is
a challenge.
That's going to be where some of this research goes.
Indeed, and there's a lot of background noise and how to make it reliable. And just to give you an idea, something very stupid, very simple, like a radio frequency. You're told to change frequency to 1 to 8 decimal 8, for example, on VHF. And okay, you then key in 1 to 8 decimal 8, 1 to 8.8 on the radios. If you just say 1 to 8.8 or 1 to 8 decimal 8 to your aircraft, you have it.
It's done.
It's done. And sometimes you can say, why haven't this done been done before? Because you talk to your computer systems today, all around us in consumer electronics. It's a matter of reliability. It's a matter of safety. It's a matter also of the industry being somewhat archaic and slow to change.
So when will we have A380s, sorry, controlled by an iPad? I mean, this is like, so I am actually having palpitations here. not to, you know, degrade any of your work, well, but when will this happen? When will we see this in real application?
Well, I'd like to assure you that flying is safe. If you fly anywhere in the world, once you get to the airport, you've overcome the most dangerous part of your journey, which is driving and crossing the road and driving,
especially in
to the airport, anywhere in the world. And I like the way the an American speaker once said in a conference, I'm American and I'm married to an American woman. I have a greater probability of being assassinated by my wife than being involved in an accident. And even then, the chances are I'll survive the accident. So you're very safe. My counter joke on that is that there's a reason why they keep the door in the cockpit shut. No, but joking apart, we can expect to have, we're already having touchscreens involved in combat aircraft, the F-35 and Typhoon, I believe, aircraft. You already speak, the pilots already speak to the aircraft with a limited number of words. The next step is to get that on commercial aircraft. You can see that in the next decade.
Okay, so it's actually quite quick.
And use of touchscreens is already coming in now.
Is there any dangers of hacking and things like that, though, from the back seats?
Well,
you know, we already can't use our, you know, phones on planes, or soon we will be able to use our phones on planes. Is there something there? Or?
Indeed. First of all, to be able to hack something, you have to have access to it. There are ways and means of how to hardwire systems to make it impossible to hack. If I have a wired system, the chances of hacking are very, very low.
Okay.
And I don't have physical connectivity to the elsewhere. So on an aircraft, systems can be very, very safe.
So this technology is been created at the University of Malta. It's going to end up on aeroplanes. Is that something, have you got patents and things like that involved? Is it something you're working with other universities, or is this is a Malta-grown initiative?
This is a one of the few areas where we're not working in collaboration explicitly with international partners. There are many reasons for that, but this is a homegrown indigenous design brought about by the University of Malta and a company called Quiero Limited, which is a company made made of experienced airline pilots, and that is a very, very, they provide a very, very strong asset to our research. We have competing designs with industry.
Okay.
So we are not the first to try to use touchscreens or voice in aviation. There's Rockwell Collins, there's Thales, there's Honeywell, who all have their designs. And we provide some solutions that we believe are superior to other existent arts. So we do have a patent application currently under review by the United States Patent Office, pending award. And the idea is then to take it on from there. The way things work is that you then pass on ideas and technologies. So we are very well aware that what might end up, if things do end up on the flight deck, they might end up quite unrecognizable, because it is the technology you pass on and the ideas, which then the companies make their own and take advantage of your own research and innovation, but then they will make it their own and morph it into their own packages and products.
So how long does it take? So from once the idea is, you know, somebody wakes up with the idea to sort of start along this research program, how long does it take then to get to the stage where, or how long has it taken to get to the stage where you're filing your patents?
Well, relatively quite quick in aeronautical development terms. You come up with an idea, you've got to look for funding, you've got to set up the partnerships, you've got to set up the environment, and after that is done, then it takes about a year, maybe 2 years of coming in with the initial concept development. By that time, you will be able to have a confidence in knowing what to file and protect, so that is the time you file. The filing, from filing to award, it's approximately 2 years. So that's a 4 to 5 year time period. And by that time, you have a concept, which is at what is called technology readiness level 3 on a scale of 1 to 9. The higher you go, the more the technology readiness levels are levels on a scale that has been developed by NASA. And it gives an indication of how mature and close to market things are, the steps from 1 to 9. The higher you go, the more expensive it is to actually develop it to the next stage. So universities go to 3 to 4, then industry takes it up from 6 to 9 onwards, so there's a big divide. We try to push it higher. In this case, the idea would be to transfer the technology to industry immediately, and then if it does make it to the industry, it'll be another 5 to 8 years.
Before it's used.
So you're talking of a 10-15 year life cycle.
So from the date it's the inception, when do you start talking to people in industry? Because obviously you go out to do your research.
Well, after 2 years.
Okay.
After you've actually filed. Because once you've filed, you're protected.
Ah.
You always sign non-disclosure agreements, of course. That's obvious. But you protected the day you filed. So after 2 years, you can start talking. And you can start talking earlier too, giving people heads up on what you're doing, but without disclosing.
But do you do the research? So you just you've done research within the pilot community to
yes.
get the prototype working.
Yes.
So they're all under NDA as well. So this is quite yes. an important aspect.
Yes.
Going
and there's what is also important, I'm sorry I butted in here.
No.
But what is also important that you must know the market very well. The only reason why we could seriously take on such high-value research is because we know the industry. We've been working with the industry. We've been watching them. They've been watching us. You can't just come in out of nothing. Let me invent something with not having any background. That will be a recipe for failure.
So Malta's quite known for doing research then in this space, but we don't hear about it as mere mortals.
No, we're all mere mortals. what happens is that in reality there are two issues here coming in. One is that the aviation community is very small, so we always end up working with the same people. And when people move around, they go from one company to another, so they surface again elsewhere. There's an old boy network going on, which is quite good, and it's quite healthy. And when you start getting people respecting you, then, of course, unless you do something wrong, the respect grows and grows. And we now enjoy a fair level of respect in the international community, and we're satisfied with that. The other part, so we're known in the industry, but then the industry is a closed shop. The other part is that we're so overwhelmed with our own activities that we have very little opportunity to extend this to the general public. And this is one of the few times we have to actually spend effort to go out and tell the public what we're doing, which is in a way a responsibility of the University of Malta, because we are, at the end of the day, a publicly funded organization.
I also think we should all be very proud of you doing what you're doing and getting on the international map. And
it does provide satisfaction to the career, because at the end of the day, an academic is fulfilled by teaching, but by also having an international research profile, by working internationally with collaborations abroad. We travel all over Europe. We presented our work worldwide, recently in Korea, most recently. The next will be in Brussels in a few weeks' time. So we get on the international network. And of course, winning competitive funds also is a great satisfaction. Being awarded patents, publications, academic publications, and of course, transferring technology to industry. I think that is also, that brings a whole career to its pinnacle.
And what about, because I'm just thinking, the length of time it takes for these ideas to come to fruition, are you passing on your knowledge and to students? Is it a very active community that's growing?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I teach a full load, despite being involved in such research activities, handling about 4 or 5 contracts at the same time, and also being a director of a growing institute with new sites on new courses of value to the community. But I'm happy to provide a full load, to work with a full teaching load, because it gives me the opportunity to pass on indirectly the experience I have achieved in entrepreneurship, in style, in what the industry wants, in the caliber, in the culture, in the ethos of the industry, and in training students that there is an education goes beyond teaching the subject material. Education goes towards creating characters and creating professions. So passing on the extracurricular, I would say, values are very important. That is the S part. The no part is that, unfortunately, our work is so specialized and high-tech that it's nigh on impossible for even an MSc student to do a decent job.
Right.
So you've got to have very specialized, very, very advanced studies. This goes beyond just having somebody who's a graduate starting to work. So when it comes to studentships, it's a bit beyond them. When it comes to even MSc's, It's a tight call. That is a downside of it. But of course, we have other areas where we operate and we design UAV.
What's a UAV?
Drones.
Drones. Okay.
We design autopilot for drones. We design electronic airborne monitoring equipment for drones, and those things can be done by undergraduate and postgraduate students. So we do engage in that respect, but it's not as advanced as and as exciting, perhaps, as what I've been telling you about controlling an aircraft from a touchscreen.
Yes, you think that's exciting? I think that's interesting. I think is the word. I think the Italians would say molto particolare, wouldn't they? So tell us a bit more about these drones, because you hear lots of people coming up ideas that pizza will be delivered by drones, and there was a story recently with the BBC about blood being delivered into, I believe it was Uganda. It's a very hilly country. They never get blood to people in time. Is that the kind of thing you're looking at?
I was brought up in the 70s, and we used to watch Space 1999.
Yes, me too.
So 1999 has come and gone a long time ago, and we still don't have Eagle One going onto the moon regularly. So but then on the other hand, you could see certain things about the internet before internet came along in film. So, it's a toss of a coin as what really will happen and what won't happen. But the idea is to put in drones. Drones meaning these helicopter quadrotor things which you see flying around. Or also big vehicles which fly and deliver payloads, weaponry meaning, in the battlefield. There are drones that are bigger in wingspan that an aircraft that fly into the UK.
Okay.
So there's a whole range of unmanned airplanes, ranging from these little fly-sized things that will go inside buildings to big aircraft taking a large payload. So the idea is that they will change the way we will communicate and change the way we do things, just the way internet has changed things in many ways. So delivering pizza could be one of them. Amazon is very keen on that.
Me too.
Ryanair is very keen on reducing the number of people in the cockpit, possibly to zero. And we're moving in that direction, maybe not in our lifetime, because it's also a psychological shock.
Yes, absolutely.
But possibly computers one day will be safer than human beings. Not at this stage. I don't believe so. But drones are here to stay, and the challenge is to actually make space for them to live around us.
No pun intended. So what do you do in that aspect? Because there was a project called RAID.
Yes.
Here, tell us a bit more about the RAID project.
Well, RAID was one area which excited us because it was an operational research program. It was not designed to develop technology. You see, the technology already exists. Okay. The aircraft you fly, an A320, which was designed in the 1980s, so the people who design A380 are coming to retirement today.
Mm-hmm.
That's how old the aircraft, not the aircraft Air Malta have, because the A380 is the state-of-the-art narrow-body aircraft, which everybody has. There are 6,000 or so aircraft around or on order. So same with the 737. The state-of-the-art aircraft which British Airways, Lufthansa, Air Malta, and other aircraft fly, and our 1980s technology, those aircraft can fly automatically from just after takeoff to after landing. Mm-hmm. So they are really...
Sort of unmanned.
Mm. And these technologies have been around, and anybody can take off an aircraft. Anything can take off an aircraft. So it's really already an unmanned aircraft with a person on board, if you want to be cynical. The technology is not the problem. The problem is to render the systems reliable enough and reliable in the operational environment, operating in air traffic, in bad weather, in the environment of tactical changes, in environments of potentially also willful interference. Mm-hmm. We see, for example, people very irresponsibly shine lasers on aircraft coming into land, into pilot cockpits.
Yes.
And that is a criminal offense, and mm-hmm. that happens quite frequently. So there are always these people who are trying to interfere with the operational system, and the challenge is how to integrate unmanned aircraft mm-hmm. safely with manned aircraft, with all the changes that happen in real time. And the realities are that we have the accident, the safety record is that there is a fatal accident every 1 million hours.
Of flight time. Okay.
So you're not going to be there. And it's a very good safety record. The challenge is that the air traffic is going to double in the next 20 years, and we want to improve the safety record. So that's a double challenge.
Okay.
So we already have the challenges with manned aircraft. When you put in another factor of man-manned aviation, that's going to scratch a few heads. So this research was funded by CESAR, which is the European flagship in the next generation air traffic management environment,
okay.
which is led by Eurocontrol. And there's a similar parallel program in the US called the Next Gen. So they're doing similar things in the States. And there were 9 projects which were funded by CESAR to look into demonstrating that unmanned aircraft can safely be put into the operational environment.
Okay.
We were 1 of 9, and I believe 1 of only 2 universes in the whole of the 9 projects being involved. Here you get the big guys. We get Thales, we get Onera, we get NLR, We get DLR, Chira. These are huge. They were flying big machines, some of them small machines, and there was the University of Malta. So it's a big impact in what I would say bottom end downstream research, because this is also research. Getting technologies and finding ways and means of how to demonstrate that the technologies are good enough and safe, that is research in itself. So our job was to demonstrate that the Sense and the Void technologies developed by CIRA, which is the Italian research agency, could be flown safely. And we did that successfully.
Excellent. Big high five.
Thank you. Of course, the partners, we were only partners in the, it was led by CIRA. There were other organizations involved, Deep Blue and NICE from Italy and MATS from Malta, the air traffic service provider. So we made a safety assessment. We were flying drones with humans aboard. So there's always a big safety assessment that needs to be carried out, and what if considerations and risk assessments and whatever. So it was done very professionally and a very nice experience for us too.
Excellent. Well, I'm still scared, but
you don't need to be.
I will trust you in 10 years' time when it's on an aeroplane. I'll think back to this interview. So thank you very much. That's Professor Engineer David Samit Manjon, who's the director for the Institute of Aerospace Technologies here at the University of Malta. You've been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have just listened to The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers.